brought to you by Oklahoma Men's Clinic, the leader in men's health and sexual wellness.
Rick and Brad Radio.
Dr. Kevin Lewis is here, as he is on Tuesday mornings, and if you have a question for him, get it to us, and we'll try and get it answered. I did want to talk to you about, because this came up last week after you were gone, this issue with the guitarist from Judas Priest, Richie Faulkner, suffering an aortic aneurysm on stage and being close enough to the University of Louisville Medical Center and being able to get operated on and basically saving the guy's life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I watched the video. He posted the video of him at the show and said, you know, you don't know it, but this is the moment that this is going on. And you can't tell. I mean, these guys, he's playing a solo. He's moving around on the stage some. He says he felt like something was wrong, but he didn't know. I mean, maybe there was enough adrenaline for being on stage that pushed him through it. You would think that at a certain point you just wouldn't be able to continue to function the way that
he did. That same adrenaline was probably what caused the rupture.
So how common is that? How big of a threat is that? Is that something that you could, because he said no history of any issues, no family history of any issues,
right?
Had not had any problems, had not had any health. You know, he had held health screenings before going on tour and various things. It had not had any indication that that was the even potentially a problem. So what's the background on that? And is that something else that Lauren should be worried about?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't take much for Lauren, does it?
Right.
She, you know, she'll have anything at any given time. That was like me in medical school.
Oh, right.
every different thing we were studying. Oh, my gosh, I think I got that.
Right.
An aortic aneurysm, depending on the location, has varying different levels of frequency. Before all the listeners freak out, it is fortunately rare. And then to have one rupture is also very, very rare. The idea of an aneurysm, just to remind everybody, is where there is a stretching of the blood vessel. And the aorta is really our main plumbing system for all of our arteries. So if it gets a bit stretched, it can balloon out. If you remember, garden hoses used to be able to do that before they fortified them, and you could get that, you know, bubbling of that. That's really what an aneurysm is. And if we find them, so they're not very symptomatic. And so a lot of times, unless you have an incidental finding on an x-ray that was taken or an ultrasound that was taken or so forth, they can go missed. If you find them, we watch them to see if they're growing, and then you can repair them. And you can repair them a couple of ways. The increasingly common way to repair them is to go from the inside, and you put a scaffolding there through like a stent.
Right.
And then it preserves it. Really, really cool, because in the old days, you basically had to go in and do this massive, massive
surgery. So the ballooning continues to be there, but it's not a threat because the stent is in?
Yeah, when you put the scaffolding in there, a couple of things happen. You form new tissue around it, and so you reduce the pressure that was causing the stretching.
Interesting.
And yeah, you can keep that from then rupturing, and you still have to monitor it, and you still have to be careful. And then there's a location difference. So these are most common to occur in the abdomen. And then it's a difference of whether it's above the kidney level or below the kidney level. But there are times where you can get it up in the chest where it's closer to the heart. When it's up in the chest, it's more likely to get something called a dissection rather than an aneurysm, a whole other conversation. The challenge that we have is when these rupture in the abdomen, they usually are not sitting out inside the belly contents. The aorta runs down basically along your spine. And so if it ruptures, it ruptures into this back area. And that can be very, very difficult to get to, very, very difficult to manage. And the silver lining, though, is that's such a muscular area and dense area. It'll contain the blood for long enough for you to get somewhere, get help, and to have your life saved. Because if it ruptured out into the abdomen, you'd just bleed out into your belly. And so, anyhow, I know that sounds gross.
I don't know if this is based on what doctors told him or this is his own interpretation of what he knows about it. but according to him, he was bleeding out into his chest cavity.
Yeah, so, and I have not followed his story as carefully. There's been this silly thing called COVID out in the world that distracts me from some of these other common stories, and usually I'm very on top of those. So his would have been what we call a thoracic aortic aneurysm, and those are much more likely to kill you because of that very issue. You're going to bleed out in the chest, you're going to collapse your lungs, you can bleed in such a way that that surrounds the heart, so then the heart can't relax and squeeze the way it needs to because you're getting all of that pressure. So those are, that's a really almost miraculous to have somebody have that happen in the chest and then survive
be on stage
it.
At a rock festival playing a guitar solo and get to the hospital. I mean, it was it was almost like a perfect storm of they were in Louisville at this festival, the timing of it, they were that close to the hospital that they could get him there, and the right people were there to do the surgery that he needed and get him taken care of and on the road to recovery. And I saw a post yesterday from him in his hospital bed talking about how lucky he was to even be alive.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, a lot of times in the chest, those are occurring because of spikes in blood pressure.
I was going to ask, in terms of the risk factors and reasons to have a concern, and not necessarily a fear, because I don't think you ever know whether there's the possibility of that happening or not, but are there things that would put you more at risk of it? And blood pressure was the one specifically, as you described it, it seemed to me like that would be something that would be, if you had high blood pressure, be more likely to work that weakening of that artery and push it out into the bubbling that you were talking about.
Yeah, the potential for either an aneurysmal situation or a dissection, which means that part of the wall of the aorta tears, but the rest of the wall stayed intact. So you bleed into the wall of the vessel. Those have a heavy connection to high blood pressure and then further spikes. So you can imagine, right? I mean, concert, solo, who knows what that did, but that's not an uncommon triggering event, because we'll find other triggering events under stress or exertion, that can cause a rupture.
Interesting. Well, it's just an amazing story. It's remarkable, really, that everything kind of came together for that guy to survive.
Yeah, I'm going
to
go look at some of those additional details because it's pretty miraculous. Yeah.
Okay, so we found out this week that they did put in for, I don't know if it's emergency use approval on the antiviral pills. You know anything more about that? And we talked last week about how that's not necessarily going to be the revolutionary thing in terms of overcoming COVID, because it just by nature of what it is, instead of preventing, we're reacting to. And I think between the vaccine and the antiviral, we'll probably wind up with like a flu vaccine plus Tamiflu situation, where between the two of them, you've got a little bit more of an arsenal to fight the battle with. But what do you know about anything new about the antiviral pills, and in terms of the effect that's going to have on what we're going through, what do you think it will mean?
Yeah, if you look at the vaccine applications, typically what would happen is we would get this information that, you know, application was put in, and then it would still be a few days before you could see all the details within the application. So I don't know all of the safety data yet. Like, what are the side effects? What are the risks? Mm-hmm. What we do know about this Merck product called molnupiravir, that's just its generic name as an antiviral, is that it cut roughly in half the hospitalization rate and death rate when compared to those that weren't taking it. Now, the numbers weren't massive, but they were big enough to have people stop these studies early, and we talked about that last week. So, for instance, if you weren't taking it and you had risk factors for a bad outcome with COVID, you had a 14% chance of winding up in the hospital and having a bad outcome.
Right.
If you were taking the medication, it cut it in half. So there was a 7% mm-hmm. chance that would happen. And in the people taking the medication, no deaths. So we'll see if that holds up, you know, when you get to thousands and thousands.
But on
thousands.
A mass scale, that number doesn't seem that impressive. Even 14% doesn't seem that impressive, which I think is some of the anti-vaxxers and the non-COVID people. That's part of their argument. But even though that's not that impressive, when you take it and you extrapolate it out to millions and billions, it's significant. And then when you cut that in half, that's a significant decrease of what that number already was.
Yeah, that's the thing that we've been trying to get across over and over and over and over again over the past year and a half plus, is that the math, right? The sheer math, you have to do it across millions, you know, of potential people. So it's impressive. We're excited about that. It's going to be indicated when this happens for those with who are only have mild to moderate symptoms at the time, but have a high risk to deteriorate.
Meaning elderly with underlying conditions, possibly.
We're going to see what that looks like from the studies they did. It mirrors a lot of who we would give monoclonal antibodies to. Not exact, but it mirrors a lot of that. So what I think we're going to see is some evidence. Well, they won't do it together because they haven't done that yet. But I think what we're going to find is we're going to find a lot of providers saying, you know what, let's just go ahead and do kitchen sink, especially if you're unvaccinated. So I'm giving you these pills,
right,
and you're going to go get your monoclonal antibody infusion because work in different ways, and we're going to try to really kick this thing.
Do you think that the anti-vaxxers will take the antivirals? I mean, if the argument is big pharma, Merck is about as big pharma as you get.
Right.
It's a Merck product. It's a pharmaceutical product. All the arguments that you could make about the vaccine, you could make about the antiviral. So I just wonder if people will actually utilize this other tool that we're going to have.
So the honest answer is I don't know, but let me share a reflection based on what we see out in the real world right now, especially with this recent Delta surge. And this recent Delta surge would be many, many people who have not been vaccinated, have chosen not to get vaccinated, but made that choice during a time of health.
Oh, okay.
And all of a sudden, when it's real,
right,
they have accepted, whether it was remdesivir or whether it was monoclonal antibody, they've accepted these other things that, by the way, are not fully FDA approved. They're under an emergency use authorization. So my gut tells me, based on what we're seeing in the real world right now, that they will certainly accept that.
I
think there's an emotional difference when it's like, you know, I'm fine.
No, I think you're right.
Good.
And these heartbreaking stories.
When it's real, it's like, uh-oh,
these devastating stories that we've heard of doctors saying that they're in the emergency room or they're in intensive care, and I go to them and they say, can you give me the vaccine?
Time and again.
And they're like,
time and again.
No, it's too late for the vaccine now. Yeah. So maybe this is something that if people had that change of heart, that will help them. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes me feel good about it, too.
I'm glad that they are at least. I mean, we have that rare instance where somebody says, I don't even want you to test me because I don't believe the virus is even real. But those are super rare. I mean, the more common response has been what I just described. So I'm hopeful they'll let us at least treat them if they have it.
I gotcha.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Dr. Lewis is here from SSM Health St. Anthony, as he is on Tuesday mornings, and we've got a couple of listener questions that I want to talk to you about. Let's do the COVID one first, because I have one that's COVID-related. Guy says he and his wife both got vaccinated. They got different vaccines. They both wound up with COVID. He was sicker than she was, but they both got the antibodies, the monoclonal antibodies, and started feeling better the next day after getting the infusion. The downside is that they cannot get the booster for 90 days after the infusion. Now, I mean, there's not really a question in there, but I do want to use that as a launching point for anything that you might want to add to that in regards to, I mean, obviously, if you get sick and the antibodies are going to help you, the 90 days is not an issue. I think there's probably going to be some question from some people of, well, if the antibodies helped me, then why do I need to go get the booster? Because I had the vaccine and I still got sick.
Yeah, those individuals, it would be debatable as to whether they need a third dose, because
you know, now they've had the vaccine and COVID, right?
And the natural infection. And so that's a debatable area. It does not harm them to go get the third dose, and it will improve their protection. So that ends up being, when people ask me that, I say that ends up being a personal choice for you at this point, but you have gotten a boost just out of the natural infection with a breakthrough. Plus, it also depends on their risk category, right? If they're really if any of them are really immunosuppressed, I would say go ahead and get the third dose, even if you got the natural, all those types of things. The 90 days is because of this. If you still have the circulating antibodies that we gave somebody that are really manufactured.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then give you...
So it could be overwhelming to your body because those antibodies all...
Not necessarily. It's just that the fake antibodies may bind to what you're doing in the vaccine, then your own immune system doesn't create the response it needs to actually get the boost. Yeah. So it's one of those things where we're like, let's give that time to work itself out. And plus, you're going to be protected anyhow during those times.
It's an interesting way to put it that makes sense for all of us idiots, that like you got your booster, but you got it through COVID instead of getting it through a needle.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And all the research seems to indicate that having had COVID and having had the vaccine, your immune response is so much stronger than people that have had it just one way or the other.
Yeah, it kind of depends on sequencing. And plus, we're dealing with the whole variant issue. So if somebody recently got it and got Delta, their immune boost probably has some specificity to neutralizing antibodies for the Delta variant, which may... which may be beneficial as well. So I think I've mentioned on the air, the consistency of immunity is better from the vaccines. It's one of those rare viral situations where the consistency and predictability of immunity for all people is better with the vaccines than with the natural infection. However, what's happened in that is it's like there's been this thing where we've discounted the importance of getting some natural immunity as well, which is real. It's just less predictable. And that's why folks have been recommending what they've been recommending. But we're learning more and more and more and more about what the combo situation is, right? Did you get COVID before you ever could be eligible for vaccination, or did you get it after with a breakthrough? And what is that doing with immunity? So, but that's where the 90 days is coming from, and really a personal choice, especially considering their risk factors as to whether they would want to go ahead with a third dose right now. Plus, if they got different vaccines, technically speaking, one of them might be eligible.
Oh, that's
if it
a good
was
point.
Pfizer.
The Pfizer person would be, and the Moderna person wouldn't be,
right? If it was
right?
Moderna, the Moderna person technically, according to the emergency use authorization, wouldn't be. I do know of plenty of people who have kind of showed up and figured out how to do it anyhow. That's not necessarily condoned and doesn't fit the approval. So whoever did that could be under some scrutiny from the feds.
Gotcha. Okay, and the last one is from Randy, and she said she had a question about her daughter, who's going to be three. It turns three in December, and is going on her third ear infection in 2 months, and she wants to know your advice. Are there any sort of things that she can do to prevent it? Does it need to be? I mean, obviously, this is something specifically for an ENT, and I'm sure you would want to send it to an ENT.
Yeah.
But as an overview, are there things that she can do as a parent? I know a lot of parents have kids that have ear issues. Are there things that you can do as a parent to try and minimize that, or is that just one of those eternal battles that we're going to fight, that tubes and surgeries and adenoid removal and all that stuff is going to always be what has to be done?
Yeah, so I'm going to try and create a little bit of a picture to help people understand why infants and toddlers are going to have more issues with potential ear infections. The tube that helps drain the ears of fluid so that things can't get backed up and infected is called the Eustachian tube. Now, don't remember that, just the tube that drains the ears. And it has to drain towards your nasal passage to drain out. When you're itty bitty, your face is not fully developed, you haven't fully grown, and so that tube is basically horizontal with the nose. So gravity doesn't help you.
Gotcha.
As we grow up and out, then the tube becomes, gravity helps. It flows the correct direction. You actually are going downward, and so you get the benefit, just like any plumbing, right? I mean, is it... So you have to keep the nasal passage as clear as you can. And so you have to deal with nasal congestion with whatever's safe in a three-year-old and so forth.
Now, is it easier to get surgery or teach a three-year-old how to consistently be able to blow their nose?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm going with the point, is when you're in that age group, that becomes a parental responsibility, and the medications that are safe and approved at that age are limited, and the ones that are there can be sedating. If you're drying things up, and may not be ideal. And that's why a lot of times you try all of these types of things, but in that age, the physics of how the tube is make it difficult. And so if you're a kid that's going to be prone to that, so that's why tubes are placed. They're called tympanostomy tubes. They go through the eardrum. They're small. It will heal up as time goes on when you don't need it anymore. That just allows it to drain externally because it can't drain back towards your sinus and nasal passages. So you got to see an ENT, and they've got to decide, can you do this more naturally if you can keep the nasal passage clear, keep congestion down, so forth? Or is this going to be one of those issues of physics where until they get to a certain age, we just need to go ahead and put a little tube in? Tubes, you know, hey, they got tubes in their ears. That's what that means.
Sure.
And then that'll help it drain. And when you get to a certain age, that'll either come out naturally or they can be taken out. That heals up, doesn't affect hearing. Those types of things. Pretty simple procedure. So that was involved, but I want to help people understand.
No, that's good info, because I think a lot of people struggle with that. And yeah. I everything I've ever known about people having tubes put in their kids' ears is you just go in and the doctor says put tubes in their ears, and I never even really understood what you just explained, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But it also explains why that's such a common issue.
It is, and it's hard to treat without physical mechanisms if you're getting to recurrent infections. And by the way, you could just keep allowing recurrent infections, but two really bad things would happen. Number one, all those antibiotics can cause then bacteria to become resistant to the antibiotics you might need later in life for a severe infection. So we don't want antibiotic resistance. So we try to limit using antibiotics if we can. Plus, it might affect some of the normal development of your own good bacteria, right, in your intestines, those types of things. The second big issue is if you keep getting recurrent inflammation and infection, then you can harm the eardrum from the backside with all that infection, then you can start to cause major, major issues. And we don't want that in any of our kids. So the less risky thing is to take a tiny little tube, put it in an area that won't affect hearing, won't affect the eardrum and its development, and allow that to drain. So there's always a risk benefit thing. We certainly would want ear, nose, and throat specialists to weigh in for folks to have the best information to know when the timing is right. It's like tonsils. You have to have enough recurrent infection for somebody to say that should be covered by your insurance or is appropriate. Right. So it's not like one infection and you move on, because ear infection in a kid is super common, and that doesn't mean you need tubes.
Gotcha.
It's got to be a recurrent issue, and there's got to be a theme to it.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks, Doc. Good
you
to
bet.
See you. We
Likewise.
Will see you next week. And if you didn't get your question answered from the doctor today, get it to us, and we'll sit on it until next week and try and sort it out then. But it's always good to see you.
Rick and Brad on Rock 100.5, The Cat.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.